Welcome to our inaugural edition of Canopy Conversations, a brand new podcast from Canopy Ventures. And we're joined today with or by one of our founding managing partners, Gene Ludwig. For those of you who don't know Gene, as I've had the pleasure of doing for the past 22 years and working for my entire career, don't do the math. Gene was the 27th Comptroller of the Currency, founder and CEO of Promontory Financial Group, co-founder and chairman of Promontory Interfinancial Network, most recently founder and CEO of Ludwig Advisors, and perhaps most importantly, the five-time Promontory Financial Group chili cook-off champion with his venison chili, which is beloved by generations of former Promontorians. So Gene, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Eric. Look, that was an overly nice introduction. Indeed, it was so nice that I actually recorded it myself for my daughters and son. They never believe dad does anything right, but this will help. I will say that I don't know whether this is going to be a video or just audio, but I see a few gray hairs on Eric's head. And I, having worked together all these years, I probably am the cause of several of them. And I apologize for that. off we go.
That sounds great. Well, Gene, the topic at hand for today, community and regional banks have been facing a challenging operating environment, particularly over the past several months, interest rates, competitive pressures, battle for deposits, threat of additional regulatory burden related to all that happened with SVB. We'd love to get your insights over the next several minutes about some of the challenges and opportunities for our bank investor partners, as well as the companies that we together invest in. So maybe, you know, kicking off the conversation, you spent 40 years advising senior management at a wide range of financial institutions, community-sized banks up to the largest global banks, about a number of their most pressing challenges. Reflecting on the conversations you've had more recently with many of these executives, what are the themes or concerns that you repeatedly hear coming up? And are there specific areas of regulatory concern or supervisory focus that repeatedly arise?
Well, let me start with the regulatory piece and then get down to the business piece. A number of banks have, indicated concern over the capital rules and just the plethora of regulations generally. And I am very sympathetic. I think that the bank trades, and I'd love to be part of this, ought to lead an effort to try to work with, and I think one could work with the regulatory agencies. And I think one could find some support in Congress where one not use the term deregulate, but to right size and make regulation more efficient and effective. The problem, as we all know, is that many of the regulatory supervisory activities that the agencies are engaged in are just tremendous amounts of complication for very little payoff. And I think getting this right-sized is just enormously important for the well-being of American banking. Now, the flip side of that is that if the regulators think this is such a tremendous regime, and as is, and or the Congress, let's apply it to every single non-bank financial entity on earth. I mean, I don't see why the credit union should have an easier go of this. I don't see why... many non-bank financial institutions have essentially no regulation. And I think that's a drum we ought to be beating harder and harder. And it is an area of legitimate concern by virtually every bank. And it's been going the wrong way, I'm sorry to say. And by the way, people think of this often as being very partisan. It's with one party or the other is more. The fact of the matter is, if you measure the rule book and its increase in size, it seems not to matter who's in power. It just keeps growing. It's outrageous. But that's an area of concern. In terms of the latest set of changes, I'm not sure when we'll be able to turn this back, but I'm no fan of reimposing the largest bank standards and examination on mid-sized banks. I don't think there is any real evidence that suggests that the troubles of the spring have anything to do really with the rollback of those excessive regulations that really shouldn't apply in the first place. Nor do I think there's any obvious answer that if you raise capital another, whatever they want, say at the worst it'll be 2%, that in and of itself would have prevented the difficulties of the spring. But that's, I think, unlikely that one's going to be able to stop that train. Notwithstanding that fact, educating the Congress in particular as to how bank regulation works and the need for simplifying it, I think would pay dividends and is important.
Well, Gene, I'm really glad you hit on two key themes that I know we've talked about a lot over the years. That's the, you know, making sure that regulation is appropriately fit for purpose for the institutions that are being regulated. I wanted to go back to your point on right sizing. And, you know, I think about the regulatory burden, particularly that mid-sized and community banks face with regard to capital and liquidity reporting, just the amounts of data that they're pulling together, the use by regulators of that information to, in the case of certain regulators, almost regulate from afar or regulate by spreadsheet. And was wondering if you had an opinion on, you know, that dynamic. And then, you know, going back to your point around educating Congress, what would you say to Congress around how regulators should think about those challenges?
Well, the first thing that I would try to do is educate Congress as to the value of community and regional banks and these banks of all sizes. I don't think there's an adequate appreciation of the absolute criticality to the well-being of the United States economy and the diverse environment in which we all live of having banks of all sizes and not tilt the playing field in any direction. Right now, I think it's, yeah, I'm a big fan of the largest institutions in the sense they play a role in the well-being of the American economy too. But we've lost sight, I think, too much that you just take the PPP program. When PPP came out, it was regional and community banks that really made the lion's share of the difference in terms of the execution of that program. Educating the Congress to that importance where I start. And then I think one can easily come up with examples of the imposition of some regulations on mid and smaller sized institutions, which would really grab their attention. I think one can take a whole bunch of different rules. Let's take the new CRA rule, and which, I, as I remember, is something in the neighborhood of 800 pages, and put it before a congressperson and say, look, if you have a small institution and you have five senior people and they're doing their business, this is one regulation that's just coming out, 895 pages, which is dense, is complex, and I've got to understand that. And then here's a pile of all the others. I actually thought that if I were being questioned, or if I was a congressperson wanting to demonstrate the excessive nature of today's regulation, again, somebody came up to the Hill and was asking for these new rules to be imposed on, or the old rules reimposed on mid-sized banks, I would simply pile up all the existing rules and regulations that mid-sized banks have to follow. And I will bet they'll get to waist high. I mean, I bet if you get the Q&As, they get to waist high. Say, look, I'm looking at a pile here that, as I measure it, is, you know, 3.5 feet thick. How many more regulations do you need? In other words, should it be 6 feet thick? I mean, it's on the face of it, it is too much. And I remember when I was in office, we cut our rule book down in terms of the actual number of pages in half. And I said to our folks, I want to see this, no changing fonts, no wider pages, because we can do the same thing. We can say the same thing. There's redundancies here. There's rules that are out of date. There are things people are supposed to have to follow that make no difference. Let's, you know, go A to Z and get this under control. But that exercise has to happen year in, year out. It can't be just a one-time exercise because regulations seem to grow up around the industry like barnacles on a ship.
Notwithstanding the Paperwork Reduction Act. Thinking about reform for a moment and regulatory reform, deposit insurance reforms absolutely come back into the limelight given the world, the post SVB world that we're living in. Can you get the audience up to speed on where things currently stand on the Hill with regard to reform and any predictions on how that might shake out?
Well, I have an article that I'm trying to push to the papers, which urges increased deposit insurance and increased limits. Some policymakers have suggested 25 million. Others have suggested a more flexible regime where banks could decide up to a certain limit what they wanted to pay for, how much they want to be insured. I rather like that idea. Warren Buffett, by the way, has gotten on board in terms of that idea. But we ought to be doing more. The history of deposit insurance is not ever locking the number in stone. It was meant when it was passed by Roosevelt to be a stabilizing tool for the banking system going forward. Indeed, when it came out, it was $2,500 was the original limit. And within the first year, they realized that that wasn't the right effective number. And they went to 5,000. In the next 3 years, they moved it up to 10,000 because 5,000 wasn't enough. And sort of, I think it's pretty much by the end of the 30s, it was about 30,000, 35,000 where it was for many years. It's not locked in stone. It's meant to be effective. It's clearly not been effective in our day and age because of changes in the society. So I'm a huge fan of raising it. Do I think it is going to happen without a crisis? No. Do I think it's something worth pressing on? Yes, because I think it's something that is a huge, really important element of the banking system. It's what makes banks special. Mm-hmm. And I think we ought to push on that. The other thing that it seems to me that deserves a great deal more exploration. If you read the testimonies of the regulatory agencies on the difficulties of the spring, they do not emphasize, they do not come up with ideas of how to deal with the internet, how to deal with social media, how to deal with short selling, all the really important elements of the crisis of the spring.
They don't have money movement.
Pardon me?
The speed of money movement.
Speed of money movement, absolutely. So it's really it is a technological phenomenon to a very great degree, change in technology, and a tail event. And in that regard, I will anticipate an article. I'm actually sitting here writing, or will be back to writing after this podcast, which is this. Tail risk is really the killer for any institution. It is the unlikely events that have disproportionate impact on the institution that have historically been the troublemakers for finance, beginnings of time. There is too little focus by financial institutions and regulators on that. There's too much complication and time spent on the center of the distribution curve. Bankers know how to bank. They don't need to be told all the normal, everyday, routine things they have to do with regard to credit risk and market risk, et cetera. But what is helpful is to have more thinking around how do I react when a tail blows out that I hadn't expected, like this, the deposit runs we saw in the spring.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the theory behind capital and liquidity stress testing, although one might argue that they weren't tailish enough, the scenario analysis really wasn't focused on how things played out.
Well, that's a very good point, Eric. Certainly the stress testing was meant to begin to try to address that issue, but it's a very ham-handed effort. And not because the regulators have done anything wrong, but because they're just following the congressional rules. Sure. These are the kinds of things that are best handled not by a standard model, but by individual institution focus. It should be a more marketplace approach to stress testing, because as was demonstrated by the last stress test that did not have a run on the banks as part of the stress test, however smart you are, you're one size fits all You know, one genius is not going to actually find all the things. That's the brilliance of our market economy, where it is a whole bunch of different folks, thousands of folks, that really come to price awareness better than if you have one mechanism. So as to stress testing, and it's a great thing, every bank ought to do it themselves. It really is, you know, it ought to be a little bit more let a thousand flowers bloom. And having a standardized model stress test that the regulators employ, fine. But less ought to be made of that, and more ought to be made of the practice within each institution of going through their own stress scenarios with senior management and the board and the relevant people. So that is a regime that definitely deserves a harder look. There is a huge amount of waste going into a very complicated stress test. These are things that should not be necessarily set in Washington.
Couldn't agree more. Changing gears for just a minute and focusing on the crisis or what's been going on in regional community bank land over the past several months. We've got a wide range of bank leaders, portfolio company leaders in the listening audience. Any advice that you might offer out to the group as to how best to think about leading their institutions during this time of, you know, economic, market, product uncertainty?
Well, the first thing is this too shall pass. In other words, differentials in who's making more money this quarter or that quarter. There's too much quarterly focus in business generally, and that's really caused by the way the markets work and the reporting to the markets and to a great degree the SEC. too much stress the quarter. I do think, and of course that's the raison d'etre for Canopy, that at the end of the day, one can't focus too much on the fundamentals of banking. The people who are listening on the phone, if anybody's left listening, are all fine bankers. We know all of you guys personally. And you'll do the fundamentals well, and you're astute and attuned to the changes that are taking place in banking. There, I think, a huge amount of effort, needs to continue to be put, because finance, as you all know, is changing rapidly all the time. We're in a technological age. There's huge opportunities here, and this is going to be continuing to buzz and bounce around for the next couple of decades, because this change and improvement in terms of efficiency and opportunities will not stop. I mean, I think of some of the areas that have been befallen us over the last couple of decades. Anti-money laundering is a good example. Three decades ago, it didn't even exist. And now the anti-money laundering rules are complex. The application of those rules is mind-bogglingly complex. This is one of many areas where technology will, I think, have a very good chance of leading us out of the swamp. And the more that becomes available and is applied, the more it makes smaller units, community and regional banks, more attractive. I ran a big bank. For a short period of time, I ran the Bankers Trust Company, which was when I did. That was the fifth largest bank in the United States, and I think the fifth largest bank at that time in the world. It is hard to run anything that large. It is hard to get one's mind around the big positions, even in the trading book, that could have put us out of business any day with putting on new trades. And so to manage all those people, in my day and age, people laugh on the telephone because there are a number of people on the telephone have bigger organizations. We had 25,000. Well, 25,000 for me was a daunting task to manage 25,000. And today, as you know, and I was part of IBM for a time, and that's my Promontory Financial business was, that's 380,000. That's enormous. You were part of it too, Eric. Yep. And it's a real tribute to American business and humankind. You can actually manage a business that large. But there are huge, huge disadvantages. You all talk about savings to scale, but this is the opposite in some of these large institutions. It is very hard to manage across geographies and across businesses that in institutions that are that large. So smaller institutions actually have, in a lot of ways, a variety of competitive advantages. That how much competitive advantage depends on how the regulations are applied. It depends on how much there's technology is ingested, and the enthusiasm and energy of management. But the cake isn't in finance ever going to be fully baked, but it is certainly not fully baked now. And with the technological changes we're seeing with AI and the application of AI to a number of different processes, it is not impossible that over the next decade, we will see smaller financial institutions have a genuine competitive advantage over the larger ones.
Gene, I'm really glad you started hitting on some of the silver lining of the crisis, so to speak. Yeah, I wonder if another dynamic that's front of mind for a lot of our bankers is on the M&A front. We're recording this on July 20th. We just had earlier this week Acting Comptroller Sue make public comments about being more open to M&A to the extent that it certainly is safe and sound, which is, I don't want to call a sea change in terms of what we're hearing out of the OCC, but it's certainly a lot less ambiguity than we've had in the past. So to that end, Gene, any thoughts on what that M&A market might look like, particularly for regional community banks, partnering up to compete against some of the larger money center institutions?
Well, I think there are three principles we ought to be hewing to. One, let the market and let individual institutions decide. This is not a one-size-fits-all set of solutions. M&A can be terrific. You take costs out. M&A also can be a value destroyer, a real value destroyer, because as the institutions on the phone know, that while you're going through the M&A transaction, integrating the systems is a very big deal, and it takes people's eyes off the ball. So it is many pluses, many minuses. It depends what's right for the institution and what fits the institution at the time. So let the thousand flowers bloom. But on the other end of the spectrum, I don't think we have been over the last couple of decades allowing for the chartering of new institutions so that they're smaller institutions that grow up to be larger institutions. Nor have we been as open as we should be to innovation in terms of the utilization of the charter among the chartering organizations. I've been privileged to be part of the chartering of new banking organizations for many years, and there have been some great new banking approaches to banking that have come out of the newer institutions. Live Oak Bank, for example. I worked with Chip to get his charter. I think I'm about right, 12 years old. And that has been definitely an important factor in American finance in that short period of time. Allowing the market to work and allowing individual initiative to work, allowing existing banks to do more innovative things, I think is absolutely where we ought to be pushing and going.
Hard to have a conversation with a Washington insider without an inside the Beltway question. Thoughts on the 2024 presidential race for the White House and any initial reactions to how you think that's going to play out, broadly, but even, we can talk more specifically about how that's going to affect our industry in the banking and in fintech and venture market.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because I've just put on my Swami hat and gotten out my crystal ball, and I'm rubbing hard on the crystal ball. The first thing I think to say is that in politics, the one thing you learn is that, a day in politics is like a year. I mean, things change very, very rapidly, as everybody knows. People can stumble that you don't expect to stumble. They look good. They look bad. There are all kinds of exogenous variables that can affect the outcomes. Let me give you one scenario. If, in fact, this is a soft landing economy, and if what happens over the next so often is the economy gets roaring, and we have a roaring economy coming into the fall of 2024, then I'd say the calculus is the odds highly favor Biden getting reelected. because as my former boss is wont to say, it's the economy, stupid. But we don't know, right? We could, Ukraine could go haywire, the Chinese could go haywire, the economy could go drop. And if the economy is headed down in massively in 2024, this president is not going to get reelected, or any president. That's what drives the electoral results. On the other hand, who knows whether Mr. Trump's going to get indicted or not? And what does that mean? Does he go to jail? Well, how would that really affect the electoral situation? We don't know. That's my point. Every day in politics is a month and or a year and the reality of time. The only thing I can tell you with absolute, complete certainty about what is going to happen in 2024 is anybody who tells you they know, run the other way. They do not know. Now, look, the odds are that it will, at the moment, that it'll be a Trump-Biden race. I think that's, if you look at the odds, I think that's the odds. But those odds are slim. And as I said, there are a lot of things that can happen that would change those odds dramatically. Now, do I think that a change in government will make a fundamental change in banking? I don't think so. Not fundamental. I don't see, for all the bluster of both parties, that both for good and ill, the financial environment is going to change radically, or even maybe even meaningfully. But in that regard, I will say one thing, and it's one thing the bankers can do, and I would volunteer myself. If everybody on the telephone gets on, calls me up on the telephone and says, let's lead a charge to do this, I would do it. The Congress of the United States and even executive branches of either party are remarkably thin on understanding about finance. It is shocking the degree to which congressional figures don't really understand the base of finance, let alone the basis of our business, the banking business. Educating them to understand it better is both doable, believe it or not, wanted, and it's something that ought to happen. I know this well because I got approached by a bipartisan group about 6 years ago asking me whether or not I would put together a promontory thing or whatever to basically teach the new members we get a course in finance. Now, amusingly, they said to me, look, we know that people up here that have been here for 20 years don't know finance, but it would be too embarrassing for us to have a course on finance for the people who have been here. So the way to do this is to have the new people. And again, this is bipartisan. So I said, sure, I would do it, but it shouldn't be a private sector entity. People will, not resonate there, and let's get a university. And we looked around for a university and we found one and we're going to do it. But then there were other reasons the two sides fell out of bed, having nothing to do with this issue. But I mean, one of the things that really needs doing and would make a big difference in how well banks in particular are treated is educating incoming members about how finance and how banking really works.
I think that's so smart, Gene. And in retrospect, we should have had them audit my intro to finance course at Georgetown, and we'd probably be better off in a lot of ways. Wrapping things up, this whole podcast notion is new. So we're trying something new in something new. Wanted to get to know you, Gene, the man behind the man, and do a quick lightning round of questions, just two or three to reveal the Gene Ludwig that we've all come to love and admire over the past couple decades. Rumor has it around the Canopy office that you are quite the movie buff and enjoy watching movies during your morning workout. Any highlights for folks of your favorite movies that we need to add to our Netflix list?
Well, I am the most eclectic movie watcher that you could possibly imagine. Guardians of the Galaxy is fun. On the one hand, I'm for some of my highbrow friends, I'm ashamed to admit, But I would say that the Winston Churchill, The Darkest Hour, has got to be right now my all-time favorite. Maybe even beats Casablanca in my view as the greatest movie of all time. But it's a great one. But the movie literature is just chock full of great things, and I love the Ryan series of shoot 'em ups, and yeah. They're a lot of fun to exercise with. But I'm sure I'll say this: I would be forever in debt for anybody on the phone or video, however we do this, who has any idea about some cool new movies to watch or television series for exercise days. You can never get enough advice. It's a wonderful thing to do.
Well, we'll have to add that as a feature for a forthcoming newsletter to make sure we're
that's
collecting.
That's good. We definitely ought to put it. We ought to have it as a line item in every newsletter.
What's Gene exercising to this week? Wrapping things up, Gene, lessons for your younger self. You've had a truly remarkable career in the public sector, in the private sector, and in all sorts of versions of the private sector. Talking with Gene at 25 or 30 and thinking about what you know now versus what you thought you knew then, what would you tell him?
Well, like every young person, you always think you know more than you do, right? Everybody thinks they know. Young people think they know, and they don't. I would say this. The one thing that I think is important for banking and was important for me, and I've intuitively focused on this most of my life, whatever activity I've been in. In truth, am I adding value? And the reason I am bullish on banks of all sizes is there are ways in which a banking organization, however the size is, it can and often does add tremendous value to its community. I'm speaking to you up here from my summer home in Martha's Vineyard, and there are a couple of banks around this area that. One of which is a Canopy investor, Martha's Vineyard Bank, are by national standards rather small, but they do a whale of a good business, and their metrics are terrific. They are terrific, I think, and they have done so well because they add value to this community, and they figure that out, and they think about it very, very hard. About how to add value to their customer base. That's what everybody on the phone does. But the more we can focus on that and using modern tools to help our clients, the more we're in business forever. And that's what I focused on. If I had thought about that even more deeply then, when I was 26 years old, it would have been better.
Well, Gene, thank you for spending the time with us today. We really appreciate the insight, wide-ranging questions, answers, and look forward to having you back on down the road.
Well, thank you, Eric. It's been great to be with everybody.
Canopy Conversations is confidential and may not be relied upon as investment, legal, or tax advice. Please carefully review Canopy Connect terms and conditions for further information.